The Challenger program that is coming up this summer will be directed by Matt Fenchel now. And what Matt decided to do in our Christian living sessions each night, where we sit around the campfire, is that we would go through the book of James. And I haven't checked the ABC presentations, but from looking at the notes that he provided, it gave me the clear impression that he's actually taught a course on the book before, and he had broken out chapter by chapter an outline of all of the verse-by-verse description and with his instructions. And again, it was very, very helpful. So I wanted to take and give me a chance, in that sense, to walk into the book of James. I looked back in my notes, and the last time I addressed it in a series of Bible studies was in 2001. That's quite a stretch to go back. And again, Michelle had studied through it only a couple of months ago as well and had laid out her outline of the book. And I just thought it would be a good chance to go back and address some of that myself and, again, turn my attention toward the program that we will have this summer. Going back to my college Bible, this is my wide margin Bible that we used in college. I've treated it incredibly carefully over the years because every time a little crack or a leaf where a page would start to come loose, I'd go in there and put a little bead of glue and make sure that it didn't break up because after a while with heavy use. But, you know, I look back at this thing and I said, look at this. Here I have dates, I have theme, description, points, I have colored it, I have chain referenced it, I have drawn figures and emblems. When I was in college, I wasn't planning to be in the ministry. I didn't prepare a Bible so that I could go out and use it in that sense. I went to college to learn this way of life, this Christian life. But I wanted to learn it, and I wanted to be able to use my Bible. And so in those early years, honestly, when I was still trying to learn where the answers were and how to connect them one to another, I looked through this at the effort that I put in to try to prepare myself and a Bible that I could use to answer a question. And again, I looked at James, and it's interesting because right here it just describes it. It says this is a book on practical Christianity. Because I tried to just focus in my mind, well, what is the book now then about? What's its main purpose? And it says here that it's written like a string of beads on a necklace. And the points of practical Christianity have been placed on that necklace one after another in a long string. And so you have a book here that basically tells us how to live this Christian life. Now, what's interesting to me as well about that, I don't know if we can understand how blessed it is for us to be able to sit in a congregation with access to all things. We have access to the ABC classes on computer. Before that, they had the presentations that were produced on cassette tapes. I used to have boxes of cassette tapes with all the classes on it, going back into the Worldwide Church of God when they produced classes from Ambassador College. We have letters. We have literature. We have study papers. We have teachers, Sabbath by Sabbath, who have training in the Bible and experience in the Bible. We have so much that we're given, and we learn from that, and we develop and mature as we put that and use it and put it in place. When I travel out into Africa, as you go further away from where the leadership base exists or where the trained leaders are, you have members there in church, but they do not have the same understanding that we have by simply sitting here in this room. They don't have the same traditions. They don't have a background. Somebody somewhere got a Good News magazine, maybe, and they began to read it, and they responded. And another person around there was called, or maybe it was a relative or family member, and they began to meet together, and they would bring them into church. And so the level of knowledge and understanding begins to dissipate very quickly as you move away from a trained leadership base. And it just reinforced to me when I went back and says, you know, I had an opportunity. I sat in college for 4 years trying to learn about God's Word and how to live this Christian life. And my purpose was not to be able to go out and be in the ministry and teach it one day. I had other plans, but God made his choice. What we have is incredible. The information we have, the ability to learn and apply it, is goes beyond probably what we understand and appreciate. It's hard to see yourself from the outside. Now, when I went through some of Matthew Fenchel's material, again, he had a handout on each chapter, and then he had an overview. But I want to just read you something that he stated in terms of the purpose of the book of James as we think about it in that way. He says, James is a wonderful book to use to examine ourselves in comparison with the most important things in life. We should use James to ask ourselves the following questions. Question one, are we in the faith? The faith is the body, the knowledge, the truth. Are we in that? Are we living that? I sat down in Yagua in the Northern Cameroon congregation the first time, and again, I've described it. I was giving the sermon. Mabu was translating that into French, and Mabu was probably 60% conversant with English, and John Paul was translating that into the local tongue. You sort that through a couple of translations, and I just can only say it is not clean and complete on the other end. It is not. I speak English in Nigeria, where English is their first language. They all have their tribal tongues. And Dari, I will literally sometimes ask Dari, if I say something that doesn't make sense the way the word is used here, say so. Because we have left congregational wary, say, at times. And Dari said, well, they thought you meant this. They thought I meant something other than what I did. I received a memo recently from one of our leaders in Nigeria in English, and I sent it to Dari, and I said, would you translate this for me? And I said, really? And he wrote me back and explained the memo, and it meant the opposite of what it said to me. The opposite. Because of the way the words are used. On the back of the gasoline tankers in Nigeria, it says highly inflammable. I'm thinking, well, then you don't have to worry. But that's not what it means. If you look up inflammable, it means it could explode. But we don't use it that way. We use flammable as it could explode. And inflammable in our mind would mean the opposite thing. So I'm just saying the words, even in English, sometimes go a different direction. So recognizing the importance, brethren, of these words, but I sat in Yagua congregation, and it went through two translations. As the congregation was there listening, there wasn't a single person using a Bible. Now you can say, well, how's that possible? Well, it's possible because somebody started with a Good News magazine and you didn't have a person who was there on the site that had background and training in the church, and you have individuals then that came in and were also in relationship to that or called. There's no way I could measure. And maybe they also brought a friend. But you know what? They're there. And they're there for the Sabbath and they're there for the feast. And so that's why when I said Mabu, we've built a church hall up there. Now he says he's going to build himself a room on the back. He says, I need to go up there and just stay sometimes for a while. I just teach the people. Because his background is stronger. And so the benefits of the fact that, well, one, you have your Bible. Two, you have teaching instruction. We have courses coming from an educational institution, an arm of the church. We have literature, booklets, magazines. They're in English. We can read all of them. And Michelle was saying on the way down, well, you know, there's got to be leadership materials and things that we have that could just be translated into French as well, and some of that could be shared. It just, there has to be that going out. But you have to go physically as well. You have to be there. You have to build the base by attending, by flying over there. And it is a great expense, and it is a sacrifice, but it must be done. So Matthew's writing here. He says, are we in the faith? We can understand that at a level that the book of James ought to impact the way we look at our lives. Do we have an active faith? Michelle was even saying, Don, those people are Sabbath keepers. they just keep the Sabbath. Like some people keep Sunday, they keep Saturday. It is their tradition. But that's not a calling, that's just custom and tradition. Are we genuine doers of the word and of the work, or only hearers? In other words, do we show our faith through works and active obedience and deeds? Are we ready for solid food, or do we still need milk? What's the difference between solid food and milk? The difference is, milk is doctrine, right? Hebrews 5, Hebrews 6. Milk is doctrine. Solid food is the application and the discernment between good and evil. So that's maturity. We walk in the church on doctrine. I'm going to keep the Sabbath. I'm going to stop keeping Christmas. We walk in the door at that level. But how to keep the Sabbath, how to love God, how to use discernment is solid food and spiritual maturity. And again, Mr. Fencher then says, are we striving for perfection, or are we still disputing with the letter of the law? That's interesting, is it not? If you go back to Hebrews 5 and 6, the letter of the law is milk. The spirit of the law does not violate the letter, but the spirit of the law is the meat. It's the intent and it's the purpose. So he says, are we still striving for perfection, or are we disputing the letter of the law? You know, you dispute the letter of the law, the question becomes, is it legal? That is a child's request. Is it legal? Is it legal for me to do this thing? Can I do this on the Sabbath? Can I wear this? Can I do something else? Can I say that? That's entry level. And what the answer needs to be, or at least what the question needs to be, is what's best? What is the best thing I can do in this way? In what I say and how I use my time and in my presentation, what is the best? So I am trying to turn my attention to the book of James now in the course of being ready to use it and teach from it and illustrate from it as we go into our program. But James 1 and verse number 26. I want to turn there, please. It says, if anyone among you thinks that he is religious, and he does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, which means at some point in time, if you're saying things that you justify that are unbiblical, it's because you have deceived yourself, justified yourself. It says, if that's what you've done, then your religion is useless. Can you imagine? Go to church, keep the holy days, pay your tithes. But because of our hearts, it says our religion could be useless. The word in the King James is vain, as in vanity, as in temporary, as in a vapor that will vanish away. So it just says our religion can actually be useless. It doesn't serve any purpose. You know, I can imagine the parable of the 10 virgins. If you could picture it in terms of it playing out, where you could watch it, can you imagine that 5 of the virgins would take to look at their lamps in the very end and say, this is useless. This is useless. John Wilkes Booth, after he shot President Lincoln and escaped and they captured him in a barn, or at least it was either John Wilkes Booth or one of his compatriots, but I remember reading the story, and as he was laying there dying, he looks at his hands and he says, useless. I can't do anything anymore. It's over. So it just says the religion can become useless, but it says pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their trouble, those who do not have others to protect them in that same way, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world, to come out of the world and to have a focus that is outgoing on others who have genuine need amongst ourselves. That's purity. That's not having a spoiled religious perspective. Over the years in the church, there have been a few occasions. Somebody would move into the area, new, someone that maybe I didn't know, And they would come up to me and they would ask me sometimes, how can I help you? What can I do to help? And I know I've used this illustration before, but my answer is go visit the shut-ins. Get to know the people that you'll never see. You come to church, we're all here. We're here because we can arrive, and the ones that are not here because they can't. And I've literally, years back, had one individual say, that's really not my gift. And I said, what is it that you really like to do? He says, I like to teach. I was shocked. I can't go visit a shut-in because that's not really my gift, but, really what I like to do is I like to teach. What are you going to teach about? Theory? You're going to teach about what it is that we're supposed to do that we don't? What's the point? The individual didn't last. Just didn't last. So I want to look again. I'm pulling some things from Mr. Fenchel's notes. I'm trusting it's not copyrighted because he did give them to me, and we will be using them. So I'll just say, if I make a good point, he gets credit. If I blow it, it's my fault because I've interpreted it myself. And I did pull some things from Michelle's as well. But what does it mean that your religion is useless? Goes through, and there's elements, illustrations. The book of James, if we're going to do this in five studies on the Challenger program, obviously the sermon is only going to be equal to one, so I'm only picking selectively some material. But James 1, verse number 5, talks about being double-minded. Being double-minded means you have two opposing or separate concepts in your head. Let's do that. I don't know. Maybe I should do that. I really don't know what to do now. It says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith with no doubting. He who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. Let not the man who doubts suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. Now, that almost sounds a little unfair because we say, we all have doubts. We have questions. There's things on which we're not sure. The only way I know to describe that, because it's talking about faith on the one hand and our doubts on the other, faith in God, doubting God. It's not saying we don't know if it's going to rain or not. That's not the point. But the situation presented itself to me, I would say most graphically in Africa. It has at times in the United States, but more so there. When the issue would come up of a demon that was troubling someone, and they would call and ask for help. And I have to go where I'm requested. I have to go where they want help. I can't just walk down the street and exercise God's power. I have no authority. I do have authority to help those people that God is working with who ask for help. And so there have been a number of times where a demon had to be addressed in the context of a circumstance that was there. And what was conscious in my mind was, if I have any fear, that is recognizing the power of the demon and is destroying my faith. And so I literally, in my mind, fixed on the fact that God has all power and there is no power in this universe that contends with God. And I had to determine, I had to choose to have absolute faith. If we think that faith is an emotional response, that's not what faith is. There might be emotions involved, but faith is not primarily an emotional response. It's a choice. It's choosing God's power and believing his word. And so I've had in my mind to make that very conscious choice because I knew if I was double-minded, if I had a doubt, any doubt at all, then what God had given me to do was at risk. Now, it's interesting because when there was a demon to be addressed, I knew that is what the rules were. And I would never have allowed myself to deviate mentally from that. But the consequences aren't always so clear to us. And the doubts indeed sometimes do creep in. So I just want to say, when James said being double-minded means you're unstable, what it means is that there's times when you just don't put your trust in God. And God says, you must put me first. It's a way of moving something else ahead of God being first. But I want to say it is a choice based on knowledge, based on God working with us. It is not a choice based on what God is going to do. Thy will be done does not mean you do what I'm telling you to do or you're doing what I'm asking you to do. That is not faith. That is just our personal conviction or our personal desire. Long ago, I used the example of Bart Boyer, all the way back to Pasadena, on the crew mowing the yards around the campus, got hit by a car on the highway, in the hospital, dying, unconscious, and I'm sitting there with other friends and people in the waiting room, and I believed that God was going to heal him, and the more I thought about it, the more I believed it, I was so convinced, and then he died. I says, all right, that was not faith. That was just my human mind making the determination and then superimposing that. What faith is, when you have absolute conviction, is one, you put your faith and trust in God according to his will. It does not mean necessarily that you absolutely understand the outcome. God can give us the knowledge of the outcome. If he puts in our mind what he's going to do, if he reveals it to us, as compared to us just making it up, then indeed he grants us that specific faith. That is part of it as well. But James is strong on that. Again, this is practical Christianity. If you have a letter that you have to write to congregations because they don't have the trained pastoral leadership in place, and you now have to reach out to them and write information to them, the further out you go, the more they need this information because they have no one to teach them. So I look at James as such. It's the letter you would write to a congregation who needed instruction on how to live this Christian life. One of the other points, I pulled a few of the points where I thought would help illustrate what it references when it says your religion is useless. First one was if we're double-minded or indeed if our faith is compromised. James chapter 2. It says, do not hold the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with partiality. Partiality here is being referenced as there's people that we kind of like and there's people that we don't like so much. And the fact is we give favor and special recognition or special privilege to the ones we like, and we kind of ignore the other ones. That's the fact. It's the way sometimes it is done. People come to church, and to some degree they sit in their seat. Now, it really helps in Kennewick when they move us every week, and we one time you're in the cafeteria, another time you're in a different room, and it faces a different way. Your seat is just in a different place every week. But the fact is, in the history and time of church where you have a stable environment, what happens over time is people begin to sit in their seat. And if somebody else came in and took that seat, it would almost be offensive. Because not only is it your seat, but you're sitting next to your friends. You're sitting next to the people that you're comfortable with. Not just your wife. I mean, obviously, we sit together for marriages. But it sets up, in some respects, a dynamic where there's kind of zones in the congregation where people are sitting amongst those people that they feel the best about and are comfortable with and like to fellowship with, to the exclusion sometimes of the mixture of the congregation as a whole. Is that not a form of partiality? Treating some a little better than the others because we're comfortable with some more than the rest. James says, be careful about that. And it goes on for about half of a chapter describing some of the consequences of those things. Going on, again, I'm going through some of the specific points that I pulled, but James 2, verse 14, is another point that goes beyond that. It says, what does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of them says to them, depart in peace, or one of you says, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you don't give them the things that are needed for the body, what does it profit? What good is that? That's useless. That's what it says. That's what it means. Thus also, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. So it's not enough to just say, well, you know, I keep you in my prayers. Do you? Does that mean, yes, you do? Does that mean you're actually in our prayers? Or is that kind of like we say, well, you know, one time, one of my very first trips to Nigeria, I'm at the hotel, I'm sick, I got some water on the fruit or whatever it was, and I literally all night long, I thought, well, this is my last trip, I'm not, they'll find me and I'll be dead in this motel room. I was all by myself, you know, and first trip to Nigeria, didn't know the rules. In the morning I got up, I was still alive in the morning, and I got dressed, and I didn't have any pain meds or nothing, I didn't have any sense, and so Samuel, and he has since died, but he came to pick me up, and he comes to the door, and he says, how was your night? And I said, terrible. He said, very good. Very good. What do you mean, very good? I said, terrible. That was just a greeting. It was like, I could have said, look, a leopard ate my shoe, and he'd have said, very good. You know? Now, it wasn't like he was being mean to me. It's like, well, how are you? I'm fine. Great, and off we go. Sometimes the greeting becomes so rote that it no longer carries the meaning. But in the scripture, it says, if you just tell somebody, well, I hope everything's going okay, but everything's not going okay, and even go on with your life, what good is that? What does that profit? That's useless. Faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. It's the lamp that's no good anymore because it doesn't carry you through. There's no light. There's no oil that with which to continue. James 4, verse 4. I'm not trying to, in a sermon in 45 minutes, go through verse by verse in a book of James, so I'm illustrating some specific points on what's useless religion, but then what's pure and undefiled religion by contrast. But in chapter 4, verse 4, it says, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. So, friends with the world, what does that mean? Well, that means if you're too busy to come to church, fine. We're all here in church, so that's obviously not the point. Not for us. And it could mean the fact that we don't have time to pray or study because we're busy and we have other things. It could. It could mean that we have value systems that aren't equal with what God says. It could be. But, you know, I think it's warning us sometimes about things that we don't see. We know that we're not going to keep Christmas. We know that. That's obvious. You know, we know that we're not going to walk into the candy store and steal the candy and walk out the door without paying. I mean, that's when we started. And I grew up providing for myself from the stores throughout the region in which we lived. But God called me at some point in time and says, you know what, that is so stupid. Why are you living like that? That is destructive. Of course, the candy was all gone by then. You know, couldn't take it back. You know, being friends with the world, now I look at that in a way as basically culture and tradition, because that's the things that we're used to. Again, when I go to Africa, I contend with, on a regular basis, culture and tradition. People are doing things that they are so used to, they've always done it, the people around them do it, in the church they do it, their parents did it. It's the way it's done. And yet it is not what God says. So this culture and tradition in ways, in Africa, it's basically the exaltation of the oldest person right or wrong. It's spiritism in various customs and traditions. It's lordship and dominion. You give somebody power and authority, and it's almost hard for them not to take and use it for their own personal advantage because it's the culture. And we would say, oh, that's horrible. How can you do that? Well, you just come back to this culture and tradition if you live over there for a while. When I'm with Dari now, we go back to his house, I say, let's go home. I consider Dari and Tone's house my home now over there because I've stayed in it so many, many times. And I just say, let's go home. So I come back to the United States and I see the materialism in the church. I see the culture and tradition of our value system, the media, the music, the entertainment, the things that we do at the feast. And it's shocking to me coming back, even though I'm part of this culture as well, because I've sat in a culture where it's now different. And so I think being friends of the world sometimes is because we don't really walk out of this world in the church. We drag parts of it with us, bring it along the way. And we have to be able to step back sometimes and see where it is that we have been. I appreciate Luke's example comparing Absalom and David and what their approach was and what their manner is. Because sometimes I wonder if people in the church even know what gossip is, if they even know what it is. We're used to it. We're used to gossiping. If I want to make an announcement to the whole church, I don't have to even get on the microphone. I can just whisper it here in the congregation and somebody will call a friend who calls a friend and a friend. It's gone. It's out there. It'll be out there before we get home. I really don't know if we even know what gossip is anymore. Gossip exalts ourselves somehow. It's barter. All right? I'm going to give you something that you want, and you're going to pay me for it by saying, oh, that's interesting. Wow. How'd you know that? Well, let me tell you this. It's a barter system on a means of exchange of which God warns us against. But James 4 in verse number 11 says, do not speak evil of one another, brethren. And verse 9 of chapter 5 says, do not grumble against one another. And yet, it wasn't long ago when the whole church was infested with speaking evil of one another and grumbling about one another. And it's like, do people not understand? Mike Imes gave a sermon sometime back on renting versus owning. I've used the analogy numerous times. Conceptually, it was very helpful to me. If you have a house and you own it, who are you going to complain to when something needs to get fixed? It's your house. You got to fix it yourself. Yeah, Christina nudges Luke. They built a house. Believe me, I would never do that. Never do that. But I don't have those gifts. But if you rent the house, that somebody else does own that house, you can complain. Ah, why don't you take care of this place? You know, look at that. The doors fall off the cabinets, you know. It doesn't matter. But it's the difference. What about the church? If you're just renting in the church, you're just kind of sitting here for a time and you're paying your price and you're supposed to get something in return. Yeah, I paid my tithes, you know, and you ought to take care of me or give me or teach me. And, you know, if I don't like it, I'll go find me another house to live in. That's a totally different perspective. At some point in time, you have to be an owner of God's words and of God's people. And it changes the way that we would speak honestly and the way we would think. There's a massive amount of James on the tongue and the damage that's done and the consequence of it. And honestly, there are times when it's epidemic in the church. We have information. We have access to this. We have training. We have people who teach. We have the ability to study and have Bible studies and get together and encourage one another and strengthen one another. If we do not use them well, our religion is useless. It's useless. It didn't work. It's like having a screwdriver and the end of it is no longer square and you go to put it in and it just ruins the screw. It's useless. It doesn't work. If our religion works, then we will stop doing these things. We will stop being friends with the world. We will stop having partiality in our approach. We will no longer be double-minded if our religion works. And James 4 and verse 13 says, "Come now, you who say today or tomorrow, we're going to go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, make a profit. You don't know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little time and vanishes away. Instead, what you ought to say is, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. Now you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil." You know, I was talking to somebody this last week, and I expressed something that had happened to me, and I told them what my response had been and how I resolved it. And they stopped me and reminded me, "You mean how God blessed you as compared to what you did to fix it? How God blessed you and allowed you to go forward." And I had to stop and think about that for a while. I said, "You know, you're right." Honestly, at the time, I was thanking God for the blessing. But we need to make sure we never let loose of that. We're just talking about, you know, what God allows us, and we ought to be saying, well, by God's grace, in our own mind and focus. Following God and looking to Him means being spiritually focused. Doing our will and having our own way means being physically focused, means being led by the flesh instead of the Spirit. Being led by the flesh is useless. It's useless. It doesn't work. So let's reverse it then on the other side to pure and undefiled religion. Go back to the beginning of James and illustrate some of those on the reverse side. James 1, verse 2, patience. Pure and undefiled religion includes patience. It says, "Count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. Let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete and lacking nothing." So dealing with life in such a way that we become patient without becoming arrogant, without becoming irritated, without becoming angry, without becoming abusive. God said, there's a reason for the tests and trials that we face. Don't begrudge it. Certainly don't ask for it, but when it comes, ride it out. Ride it out and build some patience. That is pure and undefiled religion. Verse 12, "Blessed is the man who endures temptation, because beyond patience, though, there is also endurance. When he has been proved, he'll receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him." Blessed is the man who endures temptation. The Bible does say he who endures to the end will be saved, and those who do not will not be saved. They're not going to be there. They're not going to make it. So how does endurance get built? By doing without and by suffering. You do not build endurance playing video games on the couch as such, if we would use that as an illustration in this life. You build endurance by having to endure more and more and more as you go. And so God allows us to kind of walk through a progression of circumstances that give us stronger contest spiritually. And we build endurance in many respects simply by suffering well. It's like, you know, does practice make perfect? No, practice doesn't make perfect. If you're doing it wrong and you practice, you just perfectly do it wrong. You know, perfect practice makes perfect. So you can suffer for no benefit and no gain, or you can suffer for conscience sake, for righteousness sake, and build endurance. James 1, verse 19. "Therefore, my brethren," therefore, if you want patience and you want endurance and you want to approach those things in a way that becomes pure and undefiled religion, It says, therefore, my beloved brethren, let everyone be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. It talks about being temperate. Temperate in your actions and temperate in your words. Of being careful in our response to the things that tempt us or test us or try us in various ways. So there has to be a gate, okay? There's a gate on our lips. There has to be a gate on our mind. There has to be a gate on our actions and responses. It can't just be, well, that's the way I felt. Or that's just what I think. There actually has to be a measure. There has to be a gateway where there's a keeper on the gate that says, I'm sorry, you can't come in right now. You don't belong here. And it has to be kept in place. Going on to verse 21, it says, therefore, lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness and receive with meekness. What is meekness? Meekness is power under control. Moses was the meekest man on the face of the earth. It's choosing to not exercise the power except in a right and proper way. It's choosing restraint. It's choosing to bow the head. It's choosing to cooperate. Just like you can choose to trust God, we can choose how we're going to respond in that same way. But it just said, receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls. Receiving the implanted word means to be teachable. And it's tied to meekness. And it means you're willing to be taught. You're willing to listen. And you strive to understand. That's pure religion. Verse 22. It says, and be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. Now, I addressed the flip side of that under the first section here. But it says you can deceive yourself by thinking you understand. Yes, I understand that. Fine. Did you do that? Yeah, I understand to keep the feast. Okay, fine. Do you keep the feast? Well, I understand that we keep the Sabbath. Fine. Are you doing that? Are you actually doing that? And so there has to be a fruitfulness that is born if it's pure and undefiled, if it's not tainted or compromised in some way. Going over James 4. Again, it's a small book, but you could spend a long time on many points. James 4 and verse number 10. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. Humble comes from humus, which means ground. So humility has the concept of being down to earth. And it says, God will lift you up. You know, bow the head, submit to the authority, allow someone else to take precedence, think better of them than yourself, do not seek recognition, do not demand that your opinion be the one that takes the day. I'm not saying that we don't have responsibility and authority at times to assert ourselves before God, but sometimes I think we and I extend that beyond what God's intention surely would be. But it says, let God promote you. Let God lift you up. Let God keep you. You don't have to do it for yourself. It's interesting. I've gone back and Michelle and I lived in Pasadena, I would say, and I've commented before because Claire had been in Pasadena as well. That was a hard place to live. And I don't mean because of the city of Pasadena. I mean because of the church in Pasadena. It was a hard place to live. Now, we still rejoiced. We had fun. We did everything we could. But, you know, administratively, politically, there were issues there that made it difficult. And I got fired when I worked in Pasadena. And there was nothing I could do about that and I was rehired. So I went on, and I get fired again. Building up a habit here. In fact, the second time I got fired, they sent us out into the ministry. Imagine that. You can't help us here. Maybe you just go away, you know. And so I went out into the ministry, and the promises that were made to me in terms of what the stipulations on that would be turned out to be untrue. Now, I don't want to give you all the detail, and who said what, but I'm just telling you. I was given instructions and parameters as I left Pasadena, and it was untrue. And when we went out to the field, we basically went down from responsible position, department head, $2-3 million budget, college graduates and various things. I was a deacon, ordained and stuff, and went out to the field. And as I used in my illustration at the GCE, some of the first instructions I got were how to go to the bathroom in a member's home. I'm serious. Specific instructions on how to go use the bathroom in a member's home, how to do the various things in the office work, and make sure that if you go on a visit, you don't answer any doctrinal questions, okay? We got married when I was 30. We'd been in Pasadena for, what, probably 5 years when we went out to the field. So I was 35. I was, like I said, and I had a gentleman in all of his kindness. There was no meanness intended. They were going to teach us to, they would train us to be in the ministry. And I was told that if someone asks you a doctrinal question, you just defer because you're not going to know the answer yet. They never asked me if I would know the answer. They never even checked to see if I would know the answer. I was told just to be quiet. And we would go on a visit, and the minister would answer the questions, and he would say, "Now you just listen and learn and watch what I do so you will be able to someday do it as well." 4 months after I was in the field, I went on my first visit to a widow. And I was given specific instructions, if anything comes up doctrinally, defer it because you're not ready yet. How would they know? It was interesting later when they finally said, the minister turned and a question came up, and they said, "Well, my assistant can answer that." Never asked me if I could, but he did, and I could answer that. And when it happened again, another minister said, "Well, my sister will answer that." They turned and, "Yes, indeed, I could." Not because I was so smart. I think God gave me specifically what I needed. But the point is this. There are times in this life you're not going to be able to fix what it is that's broke. But here I am. God didn't get rid of me. I'm still working for the church. We serve in a way that is been a phenomenal opportunity. I now get to go. We go to Africa and assist. And so, but God did that. We didn't do it. We got crushed. And yet, here we are, you know, all crushed up. We're okay. We made it. It worked. We didn't die after all, physically or spiritually. Actually, you know what it helped us to build? Patience. Endurance, faith. You know, I walked into a minister that I worked for, and I closed the door behind me one time. I said, "I've had it. I've had it. This will go no more." And you know what? God said, "All right, I'm going to take you to another place." And they were not connected. These things happened in separate, but God knew. God knew just exactly what it is he wanted me to do. But what did he want us to do? Hang in there. Just trust me and just don't do anything precipitous. And watch your mouth and watch your mind. Because it's so easy to pull a pin on a hand grenade and just throw it and say, "All right, jump. We'll all die together. Who cares? We'll all go down and all go down together." You know, God wants us to let him make that choice. James 5, verse number 15. Supposed to have faith. It says, "The prayer of faith will save the sick, and the Lord will raise him up." Now, I'm breaking into the middle of going to the elders to be anointed if you're sick. It says, "If he has committed sins, he'll be forgiven." But it goes on and says, well, confess your trespasses to one another. In other words, it's not talking about telling everybody our secret little sins and struggles in that case, but it is saying, you know, confide in one another in a way within the bounds of a propriety so that you can be in their prayers. You know, let us know when there's sickness or an illness or a trial or struggle so that we can keep it in our prayers, and indeed, let us indeed keep it in our prayers. So it says the prayer of faith will save the sick. An example goes on to go past just the ministry itself being used by God in an official capacity to where we all pray one for another in the faith. James 5, verse 19, at the very end. Brethren, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins. Now, you don't cover sin because you're the atonement or the sacrifice, or you cover sins because you bring a person back and he comes to repentance and God forgives him. We can't trade our righteousness for their sin. That's not the point. It says, use judgment and have mercy. Use good judgment and have mercy. Now, I said I pulled some of what Michelle had researched as well, just so I pulled the notes that she shared with me. And under the summary, there's three or four points here that I want to at least add to mine and show at least what she was pulling as well. Count all trials a joy. They help us grow closer to God. That is a very, very tall order. I know that. We all do, okay? But it goes along with let patience have its perfect work. Don't begrudge it. Don't begrudge it. Choose that most valuable thing, endurance, faith, patience. It says, only through our actions do we see who we really are. Now, I thought that was interesting because you can think who you are, you can want to be who you are, but what do you do? See, it isn't our intentions. It is what we actually, in the end, choose to be. So God has to allow it to play out. He has to allow us to be offended. He has to allow us to respond to being offended. He has to allow it to see what happens and what we will do. And if somebody gossips against us, will we gossip back? Will we pay him back? Will we cut him off at the knees to because they deserve it? He has to see what we're really going to do. Boldly oppose Satan. Humbly ask for God's help. There is no other way. Confront evil, choose good. If you hurt, pray. If you're glad, sing. If you're sick, call on the elders of the church. We walk through all those different sequences in various times and places. We're not always happy, so we're not always singing. But you know what? We're not always hurting, and we're not always sad. Sometimes the sun comes up in the morning. But you have to walk through that. You have to be willing to, in the circumstance that we are in, respond to God accordingly. God understands. If we did not hurt sometimes, we simply would not cry out to God in our prayers either. I know that I get lax if things go too well. And I need a measure of stress in my life, and frankly, a measure of doubt in the physical circumstances of my life to keep my focus. So I don't go around asking God to rain on me. I don't do that. That's almost automatic. But I don't ask him just to make everything sweet either, because it wouldn't work for me. I need to struggle a little bit to keep my focus. I know that. And I don't operate this life based on confidence as much as I operate this life based on need. I need God's help. I need God's help to get up here and speak. I need God's help to understand. I need God's help to protect me and to do the thing that I should do and to stop doing the thing that I should not do. I need that. And it helps me. And I have to remind myself not to begrudge that, to allow for it because it is good. And the book of James is practical Christianity. It's just filled, I mean, like I said, 23 pages typed from Matthew Fenchel on his syllabus. for us to look at to be able to use in our program. That's a lot of research and study. My notes today are on one tight sheet. But the book of James is valuable. It's useful. Take some time. Go back and read the book and learn from it practical ways in which we can fulfill our calling and our service before God the Father in Jesus Christ.